From the beginning. I'm not planning on doing this necessarily every week, as far as having a sermon from the pulpit that goes along with the reading. Most of you are aware we're reading the Bible through, and this week and next week we're going to be talking about Genesis. And Genesis is just chock full of good stuff. There's just, I don't know how many sermons in the book of Genesis, and we can't even remotely touch the hem of the garment with four Bible classes. And so it was a good opportunity for me to kind of fill in a few blanks by backing up a little bit and talking about some of the things that we might have missed in our study of Genesis. What I would like to do is kind of go back to the beginning and talk about the beginning of things. When I told you to bear with me, okay? I'm trying to protect you, I really am. Genesis means beginning, of course, and there are beginnings all over the book of Genesis. And what I would like to do is call to your mind the words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 19, when he was talking about marriage. And he said, from the beginning, it has not been so. That is to say, you could divorce your wife for any cause. More on that in a second. But what I would like to do is kind of jump on this phrase a little bit and discuss some things that the Bible describes as having been so from the beginning. And I think that you're going to find as we go that there are certain very fundamental aspects of our life as Christians, our life as humans here on earth, that have their origin, their root in God. And the Bible story, in fact, puts us in a particular place and for a particular reason. And there are some of our neighbors who don't care for that. And so it is in their best interest, they think, to whittle away at the validity of the Bible with regard to setting down rules of behavior and norms and sin, if you want to use that word. It's just not in their best interest that we go down that road. We as Christians, hopefully, are immune to that. Or at least we're trying to be immune to that. We realize that there are certain things that are real, certain things that are true, simply because God said them, and that's all there is to it. And so, from the beginning, for instance, God did, in fact, make men and women. Didn't have to do that, by the way. There are life forms in this world that we live in that are, for practical purposes, not male and female, and they do just fine. God specifically made man and woman, that we are different, and that we've always been different. And for some reason, and I don't fully understand this, but for some reason, there is a great deal of effort in our modern society to try to pretend like this isn't so. And that used to be just kind of metaphorical, that, yeah, of course there's men and women, but men can be more like women, and women can be more like men, and this. These days, it's a lot more literal than that. These days, there are people who will deny, for functional purposes, that there is such a thing as a man and a woman. That it's all a construct, it's all your imagination, what you think about the world. I've never quite understood why, if a man claims to be a woman, he's misunderstood, and he claims to be a turkey buzzard, that means he needs to be incarcerated somewhere. I never quite understood that. But nevertheless, the Bible teaches us, and as well as common sense, that from the beginning, God made them male and female. This has always been the case. And I actually did a little research on this, because I thought, those of you who are into electronics, maybe you're computer science majors or something like that, there is such a thing in the electronics world as a male part and a female part. If you... The male plug and the female outlet and that kind of thing. They go together and they make a connection, and then you get to fry your bacon or whatever it is that you're trying to do. And I thought, well, that seems to be very politically incorrect. You know, why are we still talking about male and female in terms of electronics? And so I looked around, and there are actually a handful of people apparently who complain about it. Generally speaking, people will accept, though, this is the way that we talk. This is the way it's always been. And there have been various efforts to, you know, part A or part B or whatever to try to take the male and female out of it, and it doesn't work. Because male and female does work, and everybody understands male and female. And so for the foreseeable future, at least, it looks like common sense is going to reign with regard to electronics. And I think that's a good thing. But not so much with regard to human beings. Human beings supposedly are all the same, for practical purposes anyway, interchangeable. And I'm not going to give you a biology lesson here. I'm not going to try to explain to you why that's not the case. I will suffice to turn to Genesis chapter 2 and verse number 18, where it says there that the Lord God said, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make him for him a helper suitable for him." And then this is interesting. He takes the whole animal kingdom and parades it past Adam to kind of emphasize this point. There is a suitable lioness for the lion. There is a suitable tigress for the tiger. It's male and female, and Adam gives them all names. And at some point during this process, it becomes evident that it clicks with Adam. Hey, now wait a minute. I don't have anybody suitable for me. And sure enough, God made him someone who is suitable or meet for him. And again, I don't want to get graphic about that, but that's God has designed men and women to coordinate with one another in the building of human families and human society. That has always been the case. Male and female have different strengths. And I'll refer you to 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 18, which is not a male and female passage, but that God has put in the body things as he desired. He is aware of how human beings operate with one another. He saw fit in the church to make some people good at this and some people good at that and some people good at some other kind of thing. And maybe a few people that are good at all kinds of things. And all together, we get everything done. And that's pretty cool. It's kind of like a body, actually. The hands, you can walk on your hands if you're really coordinated, if you do that kind of thing, but feet do better at that. We'll leave it to the feet. And let the hands do hand things, and let the arms do arm things, and let the appendix do the appendix things, and all that kind of stuff. We understand that with regard to the body. And I think that we are starting to lose that appreciation with regard to male and female. There are some women who feel like if they have a man around for 10 seconds a day to open pickle jars, then that's all they need out of men. Well, we still need to open pickle jars, you know, if nothing else, right? The fact is that human beings are built differently. They are biologically different, biologically distinct, male and female, and different ones are good at different things. I heard a really good generalization that men are good at thinking about things and women good at thinking about people. That kind of works. I think that's what I've been thinking. I haven't been able to put it in so many words, but men are good at certain aspects of life, you know, putting bread on the table and things of that nature, and women are good at keeping up with people and remembering birthdays and things of that nature. Not that you can't overlap, because we do overlap, certainly. But when each one does his part, as 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 11 and 12 and other passages talk about, when each one does appropriately in the role that God has given, then you have a whole that works together, that functions together, and that is greater than the sum of its parts. Again, different thought patterns. One of the most challenging verses in the text, as far as I'm concerned, is 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7. And I hope my wife doesn't take offense when I say that. This is difficult. Living with your wives in an understanding way. That's essentially asking men to think like women. And we're not very good at that. Most of us aren't terribly good at thinking at all. You know, and thinking like women, it's a different language. And it is, in a lot of ways. That's why it's work. That's why we have to exercise ourselves a little bit. To appreciate, in the first place, that we are different. That it's not appropriate or functional or kind to talk to your wife or girlfriend in the same way that you talk to your buddies on the basketball court or or in the gym or anything like that. It's not right. And the same goes the other way around. We continue to try to understand one another. And it's a challenge. But that's okay. What's wrong with the challenge? Maybe working a little bit harder, we can grow together and learn to love one another better and help serve one another better. Serve one another's interests. Men think about things and women think about people. I said it again. That's not to say that one is better or worse than the other. They're both important. What's more important in your life, the things or the people? Well, you might say, well, the people are more important, but you know, it's nice to have some things to go along with it, right? Well, in your life, it's appropriate for some effort to be pointed in a certain direction and some effort to be pointed in a little bit different direction. And when the man is the best man that he can be and the woman is the best woman that she can be, then we have the opportunity for a functional family that can become husbands and wives. And that's the next point there. From the beginning, God made husbands and wives. That marital state is the approved and the preferred state of human beings. And there are roles in that marriage. And this is where Hal gets himself in trouble. And bear with me on this, because I'm going to back this up with the Bible. And if the Bible doesn't teach what I'm saying, then you can point that out to me. But if it does teach what I'm saying, then your argument is not with me. Your argument is with the Bible. The Bible teaches, 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse number 8, that providing for the family is the appropriate thing for the husband to do. The one who doesn't do so is worse than an infidel, the text says. There is a role that is given to the man, and there are various, going back to the differences between men and women, there are various ways to point out that men are good at this, and maybe better in most instances than the women at this. Now, that's not to say that the wife can't contribute. I am aware that most of the women in the church here are working women. I don't have any issue with that. I don't believe the Bible has any issue with that. I don't think the Bible has any issue with married women working outside the home. In fact, you could probably point to a couple of examples of it. But whatever the wife is contributing with regard to these sort of things cannot interfere with the husband and his role. Now, I don't know that that necessarily means the woman's not allowed to make more money than her husband. I think that's probably drawing a line that the Bible hasn't drawn. But when there becomes confusion about who is actually the breadwinner, when there's confusion about who's actually taking care of the family, that invariably is, and ladies, if you haven't figured this out, we're not as tough as we let on. You know, we our egos are relatively fragile with regard to such things, and when it becomes evident that we are not necessary in the, you know, if we didn't serve our role, everything would just go along swimmingly. We don't like that. We want to be important. We want to contribute. And when we're not able to contribute in various ways, and some of us know about this, it's hurtful. And we try to get out of that situation as quickly as we possibly can. Man has his role as the provider, and the wife does not interfere with that. Likewise, the wife is the homemaker, and that's the way the New American Standard Bible reads in Titus chapter 2, verse 3 through 5, that the older women teach the younger women how to be, among other things, keepers at home or homemakers. That doesn't mean women have to stay at home and are not able to go anyplace else or are not able to get a job or anything like that. I don't understand why we're confused on this topic. A zookeeper goes home at the end of the day. He doesn't keep at the zoo. A beekeeper doesn't live with bees. It's his responsibility. His responsibility is to take care of the bees or take care of the zoo or whatever it happens to be. Same way with a homemaker or a homekeeper. This is the responsibility that the woman has been given in the family, and there are things that the husband can do to help with that. And the husbands need to do that, especially in particular situations. Things are excessively busy, or there's a big event coming on, or whatever it happens to be. There are various ways that men can contribute to this process. And I would urge you fellas to do that when the situation comes up, because it's not going to be pleasant if you don't. But whatever the man does with regard to such things cannot cast any more shadow on the wife's role than the wife's involvement casting shadow on the husband's role. When the woman does what she does and the man does what he does to the best of their ability, then we have an appropriate marriage. Then we have a husband and a wife working the way that God had intended. Now, situations come up when this is not possible, or at least it's not very possible. And we appreciate that because, you know, economy slows down or whatever it happens to be. There are situations that come up where it's not possible for the man to do the man things and the woman to do the woman things. We all understand that. We all sympathize in those situations. But I am strongly persuaded, and we can have a discussion on this afterward if you don't mind getting coughed on. I'm strongly persuaded that the more the man acts like the man and the more the woman acts like the woman, the stronger the marriage, the stronger the family is going to be. And study that out further and see what kind of conclusion you may come up to. I greatly fear that we have decided, not just in this area, but in a lot of areas, that when God's rules don't work to our satisfaction, we can reject God's rules. And that is a very serious mistake. I'm not sure exactly when you draw the line with something like that. I'm not sure exactly how we determine that we are smarter than God with regard to marriage roles or anything else. Would we rationalize departing from God's plan with regard to matters of salvation or with regard to anything else that we find in the Bible? Generally speaking, our rule is, my rule certainly is, we read the Bible and we do what it tells us to do. Well, if we're going to make an exception, you know, we need to have some very fundamental reason why we need to make an exception to that. Otherwise, we can set ourselves a very difficult pattern to get out of. And before too long, we're casting doubts on everything the Bible has to say about us with regard to the things we do, things we say, the things we teach, things we practice. And I would urge you to consider this. Just because going a different way makes you more money, and sometimes that's the case, that is not necessarily a proper excuse. And we talk to our children about this when they're growing up and they're finding a career for themselves and such. We try to emphasize to them, or I hope we do anyway, that simply making more money in job X than job Y doesn't mean that job X is a better option. Not necessarily. Now, it may be, but not necessarily. At no point is our life measured by God anyway, according to how much money we have or how much money we're going to have. That's not the quality of life. The quality of life is not measured in things that we possess. And Jesus tells us in Luke chapter 16, verse 13, that no man can serve two masters. It gets to be a very easy thing for us to do if we're not careful, to start making our decisions based on what works and what we define what works by how much money we make versus serving God and doing God's things in God's way. So I urge you to consider what has been the case from the beginning, that God gave us husbands and wives for a reason, and that the closer we stick to his plan, the better off we're going to be. That being said, let me give you one more point, and then we'll close up. Humans and animals. It has started to really grate on me when we talk about human beings being part of the animal kingdom. I realize what scientists mean by that, and I appreciate that human beings are not rocks. They're not plants. They're, you know, those kind of things that we're... Everything's either animal or vegetable or mineral. Well, we're going to pick animal then, I guess. In that sense, I don't have any real issue. Our biology clearly works better, more like the gorillas than like the celery or whatever. I get that, for most of us at least. But I strongly emphasize here, human beings are not animals. They act like animals sometimes, but they are not animals. Human beings are human beings. And from the very beginning, this has been the case. That God has made a distinction between humans and animals from the beginning. We are fundamentally distinct. All of the important things about human beings are distinct from animals. We are different in our nature. Genesis chapter 2, verse number 21. Not 21. Man number 20. Go back to verse 18. Then God, the Lord God said, "It's not good for the man to be alone.
I will make him a helper suitable for him. Out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the sky and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called a living creature, that was his name. The man gave names to all the cattle and to the birds of the sky and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper suitable for him. There was nothing in the animal kingdom that suited Adam. I'm sure he liked various animals in various ways and such, but none was appropriate for him. None of them fit, as it were. We are fundamentally different from animals in that way. The authority that's given to human beings is distinct and superior to the authority given to animals, right? In chapter 1, verse number 28, God told the human beings there, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and every living thing that moves on the earth. I don't want to get into a big discussion about stewardship here and hunting species to extinction and things of that nature. The overall point, though, cannot be missed here. The point is that animals, as well as the rest of the creation, was given to human beings and put in the custody of human beings. We are in charge of them. We are the bosses, as it were, and we need to be responsible in that stewardship. But that is a distinction that God has always made between human beings and animals. Even more importantly, though, that we are different moral beings than animals. From every tree, the text says, of the garden, you may eat freely, verse number 16 says, of Genesis chapter 2. But of the from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in that day that you eat thereof there you shall surely die. My mind goes in weird places sometimes. I've read that passage I don't know how many times. And this week, I read that, and I started wondering, I wonder if animals ate those fruits. You know, animals eat fruit, right? Some animals do. I wonder if the animals were told to eat certain fruit and not eat certain fruit. Probably not. That's speculation on my part. I would not think that. And I wouldn't be surprised if God had set up some kind of parameter or whatever to keep them from eating the tree of life. But I'll tell you this. If they did eat the tree of life, they wouldn't live forever. And if they did eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, they wouldn't know knowledge of good and evil. Those were for human beings. That was a human choice that was given there. Because humans are the only ones that are in position to make a choice like that. We have the capacity for right and wrong. Now, there's a sense, of course, in which your dog does his business on the carpet and he knows he's messed up and he's embarrassed and he tucks his tail and he hides under the coffee table or whatever it happens to be. In that sense, he knows he's done wrong. But what we mean by that is he knows he's about to get popped. Right? It's not a moral thing. It's a pain thing for him. It's not morality. They're not capable of morality. We are capable of morality, unlike animals. And most importantly of all, of course, is the essential identity that we have as human beings. That we are, unlike any other part of creation, we are made in the image of God. And that's a sermon in and of itself, maybe a series of sermons, what it means to be made in God's image. But if it doesn't mean anything other than we're like God more than any other part of creation, that's enough. I think it does mean more than that. But the idea that there is a piece of God inside of each and every one of us, that is astonishing. And it sets us fundamentally apart from the rest of the world. No one else can say that they are part God, as it were. That we are made in His image. The rocks are not made in His image. And this is why, one of the reasons why, God was so upset at the idea of molten images made in His name. Thou shalt not make any graven images, He says. Because to whom are you going to liken me? What does God look like? Well, God doesn't look like a human being, I don't think. But He has a lot more in common with us than He has with anybody else. Because God is a fundamentally moral being, and He made us in His image. A moral, a spiritual being. This is one of the great problems that I have with the theory of evolution and with all of the implications that it carries. And I mentioned in our class in the previous hour that many of our brethren, to one degree or another, hold to a form of this theory. The idea that
life evolved on a gradual scale, or that the planet itself, the universe itself, evolved on a gradual scale, not accepting the Bible at its face value. I have a lot of problems with that, not the least of which is this. When you buy into the idea of evolution, and particularly human evolution, evolution robs mankind of everything that makes us special. All these things here that we're talking about here, being different in nature and authority and morality and essential identity, all that comes from God. It came directly from God. God gave it to us when he made man, not out of monkeys, not out of earlier primates, but out of the dust of the ground. You know, and then you get into practical considerations. At what point did the monkeys make a human, and did the monkey parents have souls, and how did the human get a soul, and where'd that come from? And the logistical arguments are innumerable. But for our purposes, let's just limit it at this. When you accept the idea that human beings came from a process instead of from special creation, human beings cease to be human beings. They become just part of creation, no more remarkable, maybe a little smarter. You know, it's, the thumb thing is kind of cool. But beyond that, not just a piece of protoplasm that got especially lucky. And that's the way we're described oftentimes by atheistic scientists who are determined to reject this notion that God has created the heavens and the earth and us in 6 days. You are, if you're a human being, you are descended from God. This is the God from whom every family on earth derives its name. In Ephesians chapter 3, verse 14. I think this is what that means. That every single human being came from God. Because every single human being came from Adam. And therefore, because we are God's creation, a part of him is inside of us, yearning for spiritual things. So do not use the gifts that God has given you. Money, position, whatever it happens to be. Don't use the gifts to reject the giver. Don't become so complacent, so happy, so satisfied in your life that you become less dependent in any way upon the one that gave you those things in the first place. From the very beginning, God has determined that human beings would live and serve him in this life and eventually go to heaven to be with him in an even greater fellowship that's available to us here. Don't sell that for an atheistic bag of magic beans. Accept your destiny as a human being. What a wonderful thing it is. We don't live up to that lots of times, but it is a marvelous thing to be made in the image of God. Rejoice in that. Give thanks in that. And if you have not turned to God in your life, you need to embrace the spiritual aspect of your nature and accept that God has determined that you serve him in this life. He has sent his son to die on the cross for your sins. And we urge you to make whatever correction you need to make in your life so that you can be right with him. Maybe that means putting Jesus on in baptism. Maybe that means confessing fault in some way and asking for the prayers of the brothers and sisters in Christ. Whatever we can do to help you walk with Christ more perfectly and increase your hope of heaven, please respond as we stand and sing at this time to encourage you.
Yes, for me, he cares.